Taking a look inside the lives and minds of some of the world's most inspiring thought leaders.
Anytime you try to do something new, you're going to face roadblocks. You're going to face people who have made a real big name for themselves following the status quo and a lot of profit. Therefore, they resist you because they've kind of lost the mission along the way.
People living inspiring lives and motivating others.
It seems like as little as 15 to 20 minutes of exposure to virtual reality videos can result in around a 30% reduction in pain.
Brought to you by Athletic Greens. This is the Inspiring Lives Podcast with Gary Birtwistle.
I'm Gary Birtwistle, and welcome to the Inspiring Lives Podcast, a show that looks inside the minds of some of the world's foremost thought leaders to discover their secret for success. One of the reasons this show has become so popular across the world is because the high caliber of guests and the diversity of topics we cover, people from all walks and all disciplines of life who share their story. So welcome to the Inspiring Lives Podcast, brought to you by the most complete supplement for a better you, Athletic Greens. Our guest this week is David Petrino, a physical therapist. He's got a PhD in neuroscience, and he studied computational neuroscience at Harvard Medical School, MIT, and NYU. David is a guy who loves to take on and find solutions to the most challenging and complex problems in wellness and health. He's often called to collaborate at the high-performance division at Red Bull. He also works with the guys at the Not Impossible Labs and is also seen working with many leaders in sports performance. David's research has been featured in multiple media outlets, including the ABC, Sports Illustrated, The Wall Street Journal, BBC, Time, Wired, and the LA Times. So with all that, David, welcome to the Inspiring Lives Podcast.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You do interesting work. How do you like to describe to somebody what you do?
So I do span a fairly broad range in terms of what I do. My most boilerplate, simple explanation of what I do is I run an experimental research lab that tries to use technology to make people better. Now, as to what the word better means, that can be recovering from a stroke or a traumatic brain injury or a spinal cord injury, or it could be you're an Olympian and you want to win gold at the next Olympic Games. But either way, we're using the latest technology, the latest thought leadership, and the latest research to achieve that.
For you personally and the people who work in the labs around you, is there a stated mission that you have that you all work towards, David?
Absolutely. Our major mission is to establish best clinical or performance practice with the latest bleeding edge technologies. So when we initially started out, it was all about we were getting really frustrated because we were seeing all of this amazing new technology and it had the potential to change lives, but no one was adopting it just because it seemed too difficult. It was like, you've got a physical therapist or a rehab doctor or a sports medicine doctor, and they're very set in their ways. And, they were like, I've got all the patients that I need, or I've got all the clients that I need. Why would I want to up-level my technology or change the way that I'm doing things? Even though we knew that there was a higher standard that we could hold people to. And this lack of tech adoption was getting really frustrating to me, especially since we were seeing how much money was being invested in it without any adoption going on. So, to give you some rough numbers in the health technology space, we know that the American market in venture capital will invest around $90 billion per year in health technology. But most health technology companies in the United States, the vast majority, 98% of health technology companies in the United States fail before they touch a patient. To me, that was just like an incredible loss of opportunity and capital and good ideas, just because people weren't really all that willing to change the way that they treated patients, and you know, and it was to the patient's detriment. So our mission is always to get the latest and greatest technology into the hands of patients and clients as quickly as possible, so that they can be the best version of themselves.
You just mentioned the word difficult. With the work you do in your own soul and those around you, do you think you as a leader, as an individual, do you think difficulty, does it almost in some way turn you on?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, if I want it easy, I would have just stuck around in Australia running a physio practice and seeing the same old clients day in, day out, because that is easy. You know, that's a nice cruisy existence with a good work-life balance and you don't really need, you know, then I could have just been one of the clinicians saying, "Hey guys, I don't really want to change what I'm doing. I just want to keep seeing my patients, charging them a couple hundred bucks a session and go home and be with my family." Definitely this was a tougher problem to solve, and it's all about trying to influence the field, try and move the needle in a significant way. Because I saw a lot of lost potential in a lot of our patients. And it wasn't going to get any better if we just kept doing things the same way. So it is a hard problem. I like hard problems. I'm always chasing hard problems. So definitely I think that sort of thing gets me going and gets me up in the morning.
I suspect, and I think I'm going to be pretty accurate with this, that you're going to face a lot of roadblocks. And what you and your team do is essentially, in fact, in some ways, you almost have to chase failure. You have to embrace failure. How do you frame failure in your own mind for yourself and as a leader so that people don't lose heart with the view there's something better at the end of that road?
Yeah, I think that resilience to failure is a really important part of what I do. Constantly what we're doing, anytime you try and do something new, you're going to face roadblocks, you're going to face entrenched viewpoints, you're going to face people who have made a real big name for themselves following the status quo and have a lot of, have gained a lot of profit from following the status quo. And so therefore they resist you because they've kind of lost the mission along the way. That, you know, our mission is always to serve our patients and to make our patients better. And my firm belief is that so long as we never lose that mission, so long as we keep asking ourselves and being really self-effacing, is everything that we're doing right now to serve our patients and not to keep the lab open or to make a buck, but we're just really doing what we set out to do to make people better. We're always going to be facing roadblocks. We're always going to be facing people that we're doing telling us that we're doing the wrong thing or that, you know, that we're crazy or that we're barking up the wrong tree. But for me, and what I always try to teach everyone that's working in my lab is to not be afraid of failure, to not be afraid of failing. I think it was Edison that said something like, "I didn't fail. I just worked out 99 things that wouldn't work, 99 solutions that didn't work." And that's the sort of thing that we keep in mind. It's like every single time an experiment doesn't work out or a technology doesn't go like we planned, we get excited because we've learned something new and we've learned a new aspect to the project. And we always design our experiments. We always design our clinical trials in such a way that even if the worst happens and if everything absolutely does not work, we still learn something that can push the body of knowledge forward. And that's something we even try to instill in the companies that we work with. Often we hear them say, "Oh, we don't want to publish or we don't want to tell the world if the experiment doesn't work." And what I try to say to them is, well, definitely still publish, just, you know, just it doesn't need to be linked to your product. You know, you can still publish on the fact that this didn't work, just not in relation to your product, because at this point your product has evolved because you've learned what didn't work and you're moving on to what did work. And in the meantime, you've raised, raised the bar of knowledge around everything that you're doing.
David, is there a process, system, standard operating procedure that you run as a leader to keep your people inspired? Because you're in a business which is all about exploration, and exploration is surrounded by what did not work, although saying it won't work. Is there something you have as a mandatory, non-negotiable you do with your team to keep them on task and keep them with that inspiration to push through those roadblocks?
Absolutely. And I would say that the main thing that we do is insist on patient/client contact with everybody. Everybody from our interns all the way through to, the most senior staff, or the most tightly focused administrative staff. You know, we've got people on, in the lab who work entirely on, just the paperwork process and getting ethical approval for what we need to do and things like that. Everyone has to interact with our patients and our clients. Everyone has to sit around at happy hour and meet our patients and our clients and have conversations, because although not everything works and we have a lot of failure, whenever we run a clinical trial or a technology trial, some people respond and some people will say that this is life changing for them. And some people will say that, oh my God, I can't imagine what I would have done if this didn't work out. And that's all the inspiration that most people need, because everyone who comes into my lab knows that they're signing up for a non-traditional science experience. They're signing up for something that's a little bit different, maybe a little bit risky. And what I believe keeps them hooked and keeps them coming, I am really fortunate, especially with the team that I have now, that I need to tell people to go home. I don't need to be looking at my watch worrying that they're not coming in early enough or they're not staying late enough. I'm the person who's saying, guys, you've worked hard enough today, go home. Go home and get some rest. And I think that most of that is because everyone has a really solid set of sense of mission and purpose. And mainly it's because they get to always see the people that they're helping.
I think it's a really good point. And that could be used, I think, I'm just trying, as you talk about that, I'm thinking about any industry where if you had the right mission and the mission had meaning, then having everybody in the company have access and have to spend time with a customer or client or a patient, I think that's really quite powerful. When you're assembling your team, David, take out the technical skills required. What are the characteristics of somebody you're looking for? So when someone sits in front of you, you're going to employ them to be part of your team in this exploration team. What are the absolute core characteristics you need for someone who can front up to what's in front of them?
Really good question. The first thing that I'm always looking for is someone who has a level of sort of enthusiasm/naivety where they're actually going to, that they say yes to things. You know, there are yes people and there are no people. There are people that if I ask for, hey, do you think we can try this out? There's a whole group of people that will say, no, that's not practical, or no, that's too hard, or whatever. And then there's a bunch of people that say, yeah, we'll give it a shot. Don't know how it's going to pan out, but we'll give it a shot. The first and foremost thing that I'm always looking for is I want that yes personality, because although that doesn't always work in every business and every department, we're all about innovation. And for innovation, you need someone who isn't going to immediately dismiss an idea out of hand. They're constantly going to be thinking creatively, how can we make this work? How can we think about that? So that is always the number one thing that I'm looking for. Then, of course, I need someone who's passionate in the right way. They're ostensibly on paper in terms of bureaucracy and admin. They're joining a science lab, so they need to have certain qualifications. But I need people who understand that they're joining a science lab where they're not going to be following a typical science career trajectory. So when I'm working with, postdoctoral research fellows, if I say to them, where do you want to be in 5 years? And they say, well, I want to have this many publications and I want to be applying for this grant and that grant. I'm not interested in them because, like I said earlier, we're mission driven. We're not focused on what's the next incremental scientific discovery step that we can make. We're interested in 5 years' time, how many patients will I have helped? How many clients will I have helped? Who will I be working with trying to make them better? And what project is going to be my main passion? And so I need to see that level of passion about projects, about ideas, about areas of medicine or human performance science. I don't want to see, well, I'm really interested in this incremental scientific question. And again, not to say that that is a negative. I work with a lot of brilliant basic scientists that I deeply value what they do. It's just not what we do. And so when I'm hiring people, I need to make sure that they're not bringing the traditional scientific mindset to the job, because it just won't merge well.
You know, it's really interesting. I was going to ask you, how do you go about convincing somebody that something is possible when they and potentially many others believe it's impossible? But what's really curious about what you just said is that if you employ the right people, you don't have to. So what you're really saying is if I find that person is a yes person, and to your point, you said, I'll give it a crack, then you actually don't have to convince them. You just have to, I suspect, put forward the proposition, the potential outcomes and the mission, and then leave them to it. So the selection is really important for you, isn't it?
Selection is everything. In terms of convincing someone to do the impossible, the other thing that I find really, really helpful is presentation of the problem. In the appropriate way. So we've done a lot of projects over the years that people said, this is an impossible problem, or this is a problem that can't be solved. And then we went on and solved it. And invariably, every single time, I can tell you that the way that we solved the problem was presenting it as helping one person. So telling people a patient story and saying, we need to find a solution for this person. Forget about the field. Forget about what's been done before. Forget about everything else. We're here to find a solution for this one person. And when you convince a team of innovators and yes people of that need, and you get them passionate about the problem, nothing is going to stop them. And they may not, make the most elegant solution, and they may not make a scalable solution, but they will solve the problem. If you give them enough time. In terms of how I convince people to do the impossible, that's how I do it. It's like, here's the patient, here's the problem, get to it.
let me know how you go.
Well, we've had a pretty good track record up until now.
And we're going to talk about that in a second. I'm going to take a little off-ramp here just for a moment, because I think there's an interesting learning in your very early days as a child that led you to where David is today. But I heard you say that as a kid, you were really clumsy and very injury-prone. So you spent a lot of time in hospitals, and that had an influence on your career choice. Just take us back to that moment, because I find this fascinating for any person who is a parent, fortunate enough to be a parent or planning to be a parent, is that how the trajectory of a child simply by observation can help to be in a place today where you can be quite honestly changing the world. T- Take us back to that clumsy, injury-prone kid being in hospital.
Yeah, I mean, hospital work is pretty much in my DNA. As you rightly pointed out, I was just constantly in and out of hospitals when I was growing up. It all started when I was about 18 months old. I had a seizure that ended in respiratory arrest, which meant I stopped breathing. I stopped breathing for about 6 minutes before I was resuscitated, and it resulted in a paralysis on the left side of my body. The doctors in that particular hospital in, you know, Perth, Western Australia, 1984, probably, you know, wasn't the pinnacle of neuro rehab. nothing against Perth now, but, you know,
it's different now.
It was a different place. you know, my parents, who happened to be two Italian immigrants who had never even completed high school, let alone had a university education or anything like that, they looked my doctors in the eye, said, "You guys don't know what you're talking about. He's going to walk again. He's going to do everything again." Sat me down and with some pretty straightforward logic, figured, well, if his left side isn't working, we're just going to put things on his left side and stop him from using his right side to do everything and just work on that until something comes back. Pretty simplistic logic and a pretty basic idea, but these days in the clinical world, we would call that constraint-induced movement therapy, and it's the leading way of treating cerebral palsy in young kids today, and you'd probably pay a lot of money for it in a fancy US clinic. Very, very fortunately, all of my movement returned, all of my function returned. You know, I can sort of, you know, walk around and move my hands and use everything with no deficit. But one of the things that did happen as I was growing up as a younger kid, I still did have a lot of residual sort of clumsiness and loss of, you know, sometimes I just sort of fall over for no good reason, loss of muscle control, things like that. And it resulted in a lot of stitches, a lot of fall. I was also a bit of a dick as a kid. I was always climbing on different things and, you know, getting into stuff. So it was a combination of falling from great height a lot of the time, or, you know, running around and doing more than my motor system could handle. And over time, I started to get a sense of how a hospital was run, you know, and it did really lead me to one of my first sort of career choices, because I was finishing up high school and we were getting to this point of, what do you do? You know, do you want to go into medical school and become a doctor, or do you want to do something different? And so I was staring down the barrel of, I knew I wanted to work in healthcare, but I didn't know where I wanted to work. And then I had another hospitalization for a broken leg. And I started to really get a sense of who the change agents were, in my opinion. You know, so I had this doctor that would walk in and out of my room, sort of make a few cold clinical observations to a room full of residents, and then sort of sweep out majestically without asking me questions, without getting to know me, without forming a bond with me. And then I had a physio who worked with me day and night, you know, knew everything about me. And in my particular case, because it was a bad break, she even happened to get emotional when I started walking again, because, you know, it had been so long, on crutches, that she was just like, Jesus, is kid ever going to walk again? And I saw all of this and internalized it, and I was like, that's the sort of clinical medicine I want to be a part of. That's, you know, what it's all about to me, not this sort of high-level directing of services and not forming relationships with patients. So that was really the decision point that led me down the course of physio.
I find this fascinating. And then as a physio, You described a lady you met. You said she was a sassy lady and she had an issue with her left hand. And then that was kind of the next career trajectory point when you work with that lady. Just tell us about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was working all over in lots of different areas of PT, and I was very drawn to neuro-PT because of my background a little bit, and also just because I thought I've always found the brain and neuroscience really fascinating. But one of my biggest issues with neuro-PT was that, you know, we always are changing our opinion on why it works and what works and what doesn't. And, you know, like, it seems very, very hit or miss what we're doing. And I really wasn't okay with that. You know, I wanted to do better. And I think it all came to a head with me when one of my patients at another hospital in Western Australia, she'd had a stroke. She was very determined to get better. She used to play the piano, and she had complete paralysis of one of her hands. And her doctors and her physios, I was a junior physio at the time, her senior physio had told her that she just couldn't expect recovery. She was too far down the track of her recovery that if movement in the hand hadn't come back yet, it wasn't going to come back. And they told her that with so much certainty, and I was like, God, how can you be so certain about this? I feel like I'm pretty smart and I know a lot about neuroscience and I'm not certain of anything. and then the other thing that really bothered me was they were so certain that nothing was coming back, but because she had what we call flaccid paralysis, because she had so much paralysis that she couldn't even move her hand, they weren't exercising it because she couldn't move it. And I was like, well, how, and, you know, additionally, not only how could you be so certain about things, but my follow-up question is, how on earth would you expect her hand to get better when you're not working on it? You're not even trying to exercise it to make it better and stronger. And so with those sorts of ideas in mind, I just sort of spent some time with her and I said, hey, I know you can't move your hands, but what I want you to do is imagine moving it. And since you used to love playing the piano, I play the piano as well. I want you to sit and imagine playing the piano. Get it in your mind, visualize it, and start playing the piano. And on top of that, you know, she was very sort of, she didn't like the way her hand looked after her stroke, so she wore a glove. I said, you know, take the glove off, look at your hand, touch your hand, play, you know, like, I want you to attend to it. I want you to really fall back in love with this hand, you know. I want you to get a relationship back with it. And over the course of about a week and a half of her doing that, she started getting movement back into her fingers. She started to move her hand more and more. And then by the time we were discharging her, she was using her hand functionally to do a lot of stuff that she had been told that categorically she would not be able to do. And, you know, she was incredibly grateful. And for me, that was a real decision point of, wow, we don't know what we're doing. And I better go off and do a PhD and try and understand how we can help more people. Because, of course, when you're in crisis, you always think you need to do a PhD because PhDs solve everything. But
I've always thought that. Yeah, I've always thought that.
Yeah.
And if we fast forward, David, to today, let's just talk. We won't go too deep in the science of it, but just go into the work you're doing. Tell me about this technology that you guys have worked on called Feeling the Music and the impact that is having on people who are dealing with Parkinson.
Yeah, so the music project that we worked on, we started working on about 3 years ago now. It was all meant to be for deaf individuals. It was all meant to be for deaf individuals who wanted to experience music, you know, have a live music experience, but of course they, you know, can't hear. And what I learned through the course of trying to solve this problem was that most deaf people, they'll do things like they'll pass a balloon around, or they will like get right up close to the speakers and just feel the vibration of what's going on. And they can get some sort of an experience that way, but you know, it can get pretty muddy and, you know, doesn't have a lot of fidelity all the time. And it's just not that great of an experience. And so what we did was we just started playing around with technology that could, maybe help people, have a better experience. So we, you know, our initial prototype was, it was a disaster, but it was a fun disaster. You know, we were using like the lowest cost, vibrating motors that money can buy, which turns out to be, getting on Amazon and buying, you know, pages, the now defunct technology of a, you know, little pager, which happens to vibrate, when you page someone. So we just sort of, you can buy them on Amazon for about 1 cent per piece. And we would buy a pager, dig out the vibrating motor and then, plug it into our Frankenstein vest that we made, and program it to vibrate when a certain frequency hit or something like that. And so we started messing around with that, and we got to a point of like proof of principle that yes, you know, we could tell when a particular song was playing based on the vibration profile. And, we started getting more and more attention for the work that we were doing, and people started helping us build better and better versions. And we got to a point where now, you know, like some really awesome people have worked with our technology. We've had like, Lady Gaga try out the vest. We've had Pharrell try out the vest. We've had like a bunch of different people really experience it, and not just to experience music, but to make music with it. And that was great. And, you know, I'm really happy that has happened and moved forward. But then a really interesting thing happened, that which was a friend of mine reached out to me, and this was it was after we had our first live music demo of the technology. So we were all kind of on a high. We just sort of played to like an audience of about 300 people, and they were all wearing the vests, and you know, a whole bunch of deaf people had the time of their lives with this live music experience. And a really close friend of mine reached out, and she said, "Hey, you know, my dad, his Parkinson's is getting worse." And she goes, "I read this article about maybe vibration can help people with Parkinson's disease." She goes, "Do you happen to know anyone at all who's like building a wearable or something that vibrates on command?" And I just burst out laughing over the phone. You know, I was like, "I can't believe you're calling me right now, because this is what the last 3 months of my life has been about." And so I showed up, you know, her dad at the time, he lived in the city, and I knew where he lived. I visited him a bunch of times, and I just showed up to his house, and we put this stuff on his wrists, and we turned on the devices, and he had this really prominent tremor. And as soon as we turned on the devices, it just stopped. You know, it was like you're flicking on a light switch. His tremor just stopped, and he started playing the piano again. And you know, he got real emotional. We got real emotional, you know, and we've since run a clinical trial on this technology and showed that in a large population of people with Parkinson's disease, we can create a 30% reduction in tremor by applying this technology. And we're now working with a bunch of different organizations to run larger trials, work with the FDA to get this technology approved for sale to people with Parkinson's disease, and really just sort of get it out into the community.
There is an amazing technology you guys are working on. I think it's called Think Click. Tell us about where that's at.
Oh, so that's an Aussie company, actually. I feel very privileged to work on that. So the technology, the company is actually called Synchron. The idea behind the technology is, as you said, basically a thought-controlled click at the moment. So Dr. Tom Oxley is actually the founder and the CEO of Synchron, brilliant Aussie neurosurgeon working in the US. He's actually at Mount Sinai. I met him about 7 years ago. Again, complete random coincidence. I was working in a lab at NYU, and we got a DARPA grant, which is for those of you who don't know what DARPA is, it's like this sort of branch of the military in the US that focuses on like really cool, like next level futuristic technology. Mm-hmm. We had received a grant, and he had received a grant, and that was when I first met him. And and when you get a DARPA grant, it's kind of like it's a little bit of street cred, because DARPA only gives, you know, money to really badass projects. So if you're getting a DARPA grant, you're doing something cool. And what immediately struck me about Tom is, out of everyone who got a DARPA grant, Tom was doing the craziest shit. You know, it was like everyone was like, yeah, we're all doing something pretty crazy. But he was the guy in the group that we were like, this is definitely going to fail because this is ridiculous, you know. And his technology is you take an endovascular stent, which is a widely used piece of neurosurgical equipment that if someone is having a stroke or is having some other blood vessel problems, the stent can be used to open up someone's blood vessel and keep it held open so that blood can still pass through it, even in the presence of a pathology that wants to close the blood vessel down. And what Tom had done, which was brilliant, was he had created a stent that has electrodes on it. So you can put it into an area of the brain. You can get it into an area of the brain with very little level of invasive procedure. You know, it's a procedure that every neurosurgeon knows how to do 1,000 times over. And from there, it sort of just heals itself into the blood vessel and records brain activity. So it's this very clever way to get into the brain. And what Tom has shown in his research is that his technology allows, you can get meaningful signal from his technology. So we're hoping that it will allow people who are completely locked in with conditions like motor neuron disease, which is known as ALS here in the United States, or a high level spinal cord injury or brainstem stroke. It will allow them to start to control a computer with thought alone. So the idea is that they can use eye tracking technology to point at what they want, and then they can use a thought controlled click command. So they think click, and the technology will click for them. Tom has implanted his first study participant actually in Australia. And the technology is doing really well. The gentleman that they've implanted is healthy and happy and doing real well. And that's been a massive turning point for the technology. And in 2020, we're looking to recruit our first US patient, so long as the FDA gives us the blessing and lets us start the work. But we're really excited to move that forward.
Incredible technology. And I've heard you talk about, David, that the risk of brain injury or brain problems increases as we get older. So with our aging population, are we about to see some serious increases in brain injury or brain problems in the near future?
I without sounding like too much of a panic monger, I would say yes. So the way that I think about it is just a straight numbers problem. So I don't know why scientists do this, but 2050 seems to be, you know, the date that everyone's pessimistic about. So, you know, you talk to a climate scientist and they'll tell you by 2050 we're all going to be underwater and in a heat wave. And when you talk to a health economist, they tell us that in 2050 the number of people who are living over the age of 65 will be triple. So we're looking at a lot more older adults in all countries. And so if you think about it from just a straight numbers point of view, then what that tells us is that we're also going to see triple the number of strokes. We're going to see triple the number of traumatic brain injuries that occur in older adults more commonly than anyone else as a result of falls. And we're going to see, you know, triple the number of things like Parkinson's disease, which is age-related, and Alzheimer's disease, and so on and so forth. So, and these are conditions that cause a lot of long-term disability, long-term functional loss, and therefore, you know, enormous cost and enormous emotional burden to people who are caring for older adults. You know, like I think we all know somebody who has a loved one or a parent or a grandparent with Alzheimer's or a stroke or a brain injury. And one of the things that we always hear about is, you know, no one ever plans for it. No one ever thinks it's going to happen to them. And then all of a sudden, you just got to kind of deal with it. And it's incredibly burdensome to everyone involved. You know, you find yourself becoming all about delivering care to your loved one, which is, of course, what we want to be able to do for our loved ones. You know, if anything happens to your parents, you want to be able to be there and provide everything that they need, because that's what they did for us. but, you know, that takes a big toll. And so one of the things we think about a lot is that this is coming and we need to be prepared for it, because as the aging population multiplies the way that it is, the younger population is not multiplying at the same rate. So what we're going to have is a lot of people who need the same standard of care or better, with less people to provide that care.
I want to put a few threads together here. You talked about work in sport. You talked about rehabilitation. Can you tell us about a lady you met or you got to work with called Rebecca Rush, who has a reputation of being the queen of pain? When you met Rebecca Rush and you were working with the guys at Red Bull, you said you took some learnings for Rebecca and how she approaches sport that you've now applied to rehabilitation. What was your key learning from that, David?
So, oh my God, I mean, I learn a lot from Reva every day, because she's one of the most resilient human beings I've ever worked with. But the first thing, you know, when I first started working in high performance sports, the thing that really struck me was that when I deal with a stroke survivor, and I look at the standard level of care across the world that we give to people who have had a stroke, they've had a brain injury, they need to relearn movement. And so we sit with them, we get a physio to sit with them or an OT, and we say, okay, we want to get your hand working again. So I want you to perform 100 repetitions of a hand movement. And I want you to just do it over and over again. And yeah, it's not going to be exciting, but this is what you've got to do to get better. So you better do it. And then more often than not, in a standard care model, the physio or the OT will then say, all right, you're going good movement. Okay, I'm going to go off and work with another patient, because I don't want to watch you do 100 repetitions of a movement. That's boring. But you just keep at it. No pain, no gain, et cetera, et cetera. That's my motivational speech for you today. See you later. Off they go. Now, then when I started working with performance athletes and I saw the team that they had around them, they had nutritionists, they had strength and conditioning coaches, they had physios, they had doctors, they had sports psychologists, they had everyone individualizing every single thing to their needs. They had everybody making sure that everything they did with so much enjoyment and so much engagement and so much passion for what they were doing. Then my big crisis came from I was seeing these people working so hard. They work 6 days a week. They work 6 hours a day. And every moment they're enjoying what they're doing, and they're surrounded by a team of people that are chanting, you can do it, you know. And they were only incrementally improving, you know, like they're athletes. It's not like with all of that training, they you know, improve by leaps and bounds every single day. They were getting these small, modest improvements over time as they went through this grueling process. I had this real solid self-effacing moment where I was like, I actually can't believe that our stroke survivors improve at all with the crappy level of care that we're giving them. Because if you think about exercise therapy as a dose, the dose we're giving them doesn't even remotely approach what appears to be appropriate to drive change. And it became really clear to me that if we want people to recover from their strokes, their traumatic brain injuries, their spinal cord injuries, we need to be giving them a dramatically, radically higher dose of therapy, and we need to come up with clever technological hacks that allow us to do that, because obviously, although I wish it were different, every stroke survivor is not, you know, an athlete that's winning world championships, and so they don't have that budget behind them. So we had to fight, we had to be creative, we had to use clever technologies to deliver the same dosage of care.
You're now using VR, virtual reality, in treating pain. How's that working? Is that starting to see some success?
Yeah, we've been seeing some really great success in that clinical trial. We initially started with a pilot where we just wanted to see if there was anything worthwhile in working with VR technology. And then we saw a little bit of signal, you know, like we put the VR headset on a couple of people with spinal cord injury who had chronic neuropathic pain, and we started to see, you know, they were telling us that their pain was better. So we started recruiting more and more people into the study, and what we're seeing across the board right now at this moment, and, you know, the jury's still out, so we're still studying a lot of things that range from is there an effect all the way through to are there certain psychological properties of people who respond versus people who don't respond, all the way through to what sort of content is best for creating a pain-relieving effect. But across the board, we're seeing some really great improvements, and it seems like as little as 15 to 20 minutes of exposure to virtual reality videos can result in around a 30% reduction in pain.
Just to wrap this up, I find the stuff you're doing absolutely fascinating. And there's been said that to have creative outputs, you need creative inputs. Now, I saw a show, a documentary on Netflix called Inside Bill's Brain, which is about Bill Gates and his standard operating procedures. And he is an insane reader. He carries this beach bag full of books. It's an incredible documentary to watch. And one of his non-negotiables is reading. And he just reads. As someone who is taking what is seen to be not possible to make it possible, or taking on, as you said at the start of the show, chasing the hard things, the difficult things to find possibilities, you can't do things the same way other people do them. So you need creative inputs. Bill Gates reads very widely, as does Mark Zuckerberg, as did Steve Jobs. A lot of the great creators read widely. Elon Musk. Are you that guy? Do you read a lot? And if you do, how do you curate your learnings in order to be able to go and then use them?
I don't read as much as I would like to, but I would say I probably aim to get myself through one book a month kind of thing. And I consume a lot of content in terms of like podcasts and things like that, just because for my lifestyle, it's just more convenient. But I try to, in terms of reading, I try to like put myself to sleep reading every night. My reading list is very, very broad and very wide. I mean, for the most part, in terms of the way I curate it, it's people I trust telling me that I need to read a book that is really, really good. My reading list is kind of ridiculous. You know, I read neurophysiology textbooks sometimes that have just come out and people tell me are excellent and put a new spin on neuro rehab that I should know about. And neurobiology textbooks like Behave by Robert Sapolsky was a massive reading mission for me because it was like 800 pages, but it was also one of the most incredible books I've read for a while. Stuff that my performance coaches are reading and telling me about, like The Culture Code by Dan Coyle, incredible. All the way through to, you know, a book I just finished that I really enjoyed that really gave me a new sort of spin on the way I think about a lot of stuff is, oh my God, I'm completely blanking on the name of the book, but it was Jonathan Van Ness's book, The Queer Eye, one of the Queer Eye guys, for the new Queer Eye in Netflix. And he wrote a book about his experience and his experience from going from, you know, this sort of closeted young guy living in the middle of nowhere in sort of rural America to being on the Queer Eye show. And it's confronting. But it also gives you like an amazing point of view that, you know, ordinarily I wouldn't get to see. So yes, I think good ideas come from diversity of opinion. I think that good ideas come from being willing to expose yourself to ideas that will make you uncomfortable and doing it anyway. And reading is a big part of that for me because, of course, that allows you to insert yourself into many different people's lives and points of view.
Speaking of books, Cal Newport wrote a book which has been talked about a lot in the biohacking podcast, blogging world as a great piece of work where we spend deep work is an extended period of time on a cognitively challenging piece of work. That sounds like you and it sounds like the work you do. Do you actually have a time you set aside for deep work where you sit and think about a challenge or something that's difficult for long periods? Do you have a ritual or routine around it? Is it done ad hoc? What's the setup for David?
Again, to kind of borrow from some of the approaches I've learned from Red Bull and the Red Bull High Performance Program, I'm always trying to think about what's next. Like, I don't like being comfortable. I don't like being slipping into the status quo. So I'm always trying to think, like, what's the next idea? What's the next thing that is interesting and has the potential to sort of reshape the field that I'm in? And once I get there to an idea that I want to sort of next investigate or next make people uncomfortable about, what I start to do is I start to construct a camp where I can like meet up with people. So what I'll do is I'll reach out to my friend group and my connection group and I'll say, who knows a lot about this or who knows a lot about that and so on and so forth. And then we try to all come together and discuss it for 3 or 4 days. Like, so rather than having dedicated time in a scheduled way, which is probably actually sounds like a good idea, but I just don't do it. What I do because I'm terribly unhealthy and, you know, I'm all or nothing is, I clump it all together and I'm like, okay, over 4 days, we're going to do a deep dive on this and we're all going to do it together and we're all going to live in one space and we're all going to just focus on it and come out the other end with a program and some deliverables and some ideas that are going to help us come up with the next set of ideas and next set of questions.
I think the stuff you talk about, David, is not just science and health related, but it's business and people related. The work you do, the mission you have and the breakthroughs you're having, it must be so fulfilling to be able to go home each night being able to say that you either made a difference or you are making a difference. I think it's absolutely wonderful the work you're doing. For people and the people you're working with around the world, the different organizations, is very impressive. Where do people find out more about you, the lab, the technologies around stroke, Parkinson's? Where's the hub for David?
I think These days, if you Google my name and the Abilities Research Center, you should get redirected to a Mount Sinai website that has the most complete information about who we are and what we're doing right now. We have a couple of websites that we'll be launching soon about our performance research, which sadly are not up and running right now, but you know, we'll get there. And then also on Twitter and Instagram, I'm at Petrino Lab, and we especially on Instagram, we do a real effort to sort of get a lot of good content up there about who we're working with, what we're doing across the range of human performance all the way through to sort of advanced technology and rehab. So, and we curate that Instagram page quite a bit. So people often reach out to us on that and ask us questions and enter into conversations with us.
Well, David, this has been great. Thank you so much for getting Inspiring Lives into your busy schedule for Athletic Greens. And on behalf of me and Australians, you're doing us proud, mate. Keep fighting the fight. Keep doing the great work, taking on the difficult things. And we'll be sure to keep in touch with you, mate.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
So that's today's show. There are loads more incredible guests in the weeks to come on the Inspiring Lives podcast. All the show notes, you'll find them at athleticgreens.com. In the weeks ahead, we sit down with many more outstanding performers, all who share their recipe for how we can live our own inspiring life.
The Inspiring Lives podcast, brought to you by Athletic Greens. New episodes out every other Monday morning. Tune in and subscribe on the Apple Podcasts app or your favorite podcast platform.